From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A battle for a city in northern Iraq between two factions, both of whom were backed by the U.S., and neither of which were terrorist groups. RT's Ilya Petrenko has more.
Gunshots in one of the largest cities in the north of Iraq after the Kurdish units, also known as Peshmerga, and the Iraqi army in Cold War largely successful against ISIL. It is now all about showing who's boss in northern Iraq, and in particular, in Kirkuk. Back in 2014, the Kurds basically took full control of it, while the Iraqi army were hopelessly losing the country to Islamic State. Across the border in Syria, similar story. The Kurdish units have done a great job in taking over land from Daesh. And no matter what the government in Damascus has to say, they want to keep it. Period.
We asked Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international relations at Moscow State University, what it all means.
In the last few days, we have seen what was somewhat inevitable happen in Iraq, and it has repercussions into Syria and with the Kurdish areas throughout the region, the four states that they have a significant minority in, being Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran. And all of this was completely predictable. A lot of it is the fault of the United States. And if you've been, listening to our discussions, about Syria over the past year or so, I think you probably would have seen a lot of this coming. So this primarily has to do locally with the Kurds. Now, the Kurds are widely considered the largest ethnicity or nation, if you will, without a nation state of their own. Some of you may, then accept calls for a Kurdish self-determination, as was held just weeks ago in Iraq. There was a referendum arranged by the KRG, the Kurdish regional government in control of much of northern Iraq, a referendum that, for those that participated anyway, gave a resounding 92.7% in favor of Kurdish independence from Iraq, for Kurd to create their own state. Now, if you accept the idea of Kurdish self-determination, of course, you're supporting the ideology of ethnic nationalism, the European ideology that was exported and forced on the world and then in the declining days of colonialism. And of course, there were a lot of problems with the way the ex-colonial lines were drawn. But, that's because nations, ethnicities, religions, peoples aren't divided into nice, neat little lines.
Yeah.
Nation states were manufactured in Europe through hundreds of years of genocidal, fratricidal warfare. The Hundred Years' War, the 80 Years' War, the Wars of Spanish Succession, World War I, World War II, the Yugoslav Wars,
yeah,
all the way up into the civil conflict in Ukraine today.
Yep.
And also with the twin with that, the processes of modernity. State religions, public education, or mass communications, radio, TV, all of these things. It took a long time to create the nation states that we have today.
And that's only, the things that evolved on their own and or through all these struggles. In addition to that, the post-colonial period, a lot of these things were stoked yet again. First of all, the nation states that were created in the colonial world were created to exacerbate national tensions. They would split up this national group and that national group and force them into a nation state and have them at each other's throats while they walked off with the gold. And there was more of that, and there was a very selective, and still this happens today, very selective let's bestow legitimacy on the self-determination of these people. Just happens to be where all the coal tan is, and the government's just about to tax us for it. You know, that kind of stuff. So there's all kinds of mischief making that goes with it also.
Yeah, there's a lot about geopolitics, resource grabbing, divide and conquer. I think that has played a whole part into the history of that. So the Kurds are, while they are this large ethnicity across these four states, they are also extremely divided amongst themselves. And we've talked about them before. They are by far not a monolith. Within each state, the Kurdish groups are vastly different from each other. And then within each state, again, they are also divided up into various different groups. The Kurds in Syria and Turkey are largely of a socialist or perhaps more accurately anarcho-Marxist nature. And that's the PKK that we're talking about there, although the Kurds under the American influence, the Syrian Democratic Forces for the last 2 years, might have wandered a bit from that particular path.
Right.
There are Kurds in Syria, Kurdish tribes that fought with ISIS, that right. adopted Salafism. There are mainstream Sunni Kurds. The Kurds have amongst them four, they're divided among four states. They have four different languages across the region. They're divided among 12 religions, and then they're divided among clans and political parties, and often those two are synonymous.
Yeah.
In Iraq, Iraqi Kurdistan, the KRG, there is two powerful clans. The Barzani, which are the ruling clan, and then kind of an opposition clan, the Talabani. And the Barzani, they control the political party, which is the Kurdish Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. While the Talabanis control the Democratic, the Kurdistani Patriotic Union, and these two parties, have significant differences between them. They each have their own Peshmerga militias. They each have their own interests. The Barzani clan have had been in ascendance for a long time. They have, Masoud Barzani is the long-standing president. His term has expired years ago. He's still reigning in office. And the prime minister is also a Barzani. They have interesting allies. Their allies have always been the U.S., since 2003 or even before that, actually. Dating back to the first Gulf War. They have a lot of links, the Barzani family, with Israel and with international neocons. Have always been big supporters of, while not necessarily the Kurds in Syria, of the Barzani clan in Iraq. And up until just this last couple of weeks, up until this Kurdish referendum, the Barzani clan was also in an alliance of convenience with the Erdogan regime in Turkey, and the Barzani ruled KRG, the Kurdish regional government, has had de facto autonomy in a federalized Iraq since 2003, since the U.S. came in, overthrew Saddam Hussein, and installed a new government there. They've also been slowly expanding outside those originally agreed on regions, starting in 2003 and then really accelerating in 2014, when in the midst of this expansion, this creation and expansion of ISIS, and ISIS seizing Mosul, and the Iraqi army at that time was near collapse, and they were even approaching Baghdad. The Kurds stepped up. They resisted ISIS, but they also enacted their own land grab. And in particular, they grabbed the central Iraqi city of Kirkuk. Now, historically, Kirkuk has had a large Kurdish population, supposedly in history, but in the modern day, they it is an Arab and Turkmen majority city with a significant Kurdish minority. Kirkuk region of Iraq is about 40. Northern Iraq is about 40% of Iraq's oil supply, and 65% of that is right within Kirkuk region, right around the city itself. So you're looking at about 25% of all of Iraq's oil is centered around Kirkuk. It is a prize.
Yeah.
An independent KRG Kurdistan is not really a viable state without that income coming in. And if you take that away from the Iraqi government, it likely likewise becomes significantly diminished.
And which is barely viable as it is. It's been tottering since they set it up. Yeah.
So any government in Baghdad that could resist, and it hasn't been able to until recently, would never accept this Kurdish, basically, annexation of Kirkuk and other areas all along there. Up until a week ago, the KRG, the Kurdish Regional Government, had seized lands comprising an extra 40% of what was their own territory. They seized another 40% on top of that. Mm. And Kirkuk was the big prize out of all of this, but there was also other principal, second tier cities in Iraq. Sinjar, which is the Yazidi Iraqi minority, are a majority there. Border crossings with Syria and all along. You can take a look at the maps.
Yeah.
If you're looking for something to read, Moon of Alabama has some excellent posts, the Moon of Alabama blog on all of this. Also, Al Mazdar, the Lebanese pro-Syrian new online news has practically up to the day maps of what is going on, an area that the Iraqi government has now recovered.
Yeah.
So this all came to a crux when the Barzanis, feeling some political weakness, declared this independence referendum. Yeah. Now, supposedly, he believed that he had wide international support for this.
Barzani.
Barzani. Yeah, yeah. But when it came down and it happened, predictably, no one supported the independence movement. Certainly none of the regional powers did. Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran, who all fear having large chunks of their own territory seized in similar Kurdish secession movements. But also even the U.S. once again withdrew their support for the Kurds. You think that the Kurds would have learned their lesson back in the aftermath of the first Gulf War, right, in the 1990s. But they didn't.
Right.
And they hitched their horse cart to the United States again, relied on them, and they are not a reliable partner. That once again, they've thrown the Kurds under the bus.
And now they're
I fully expect
again,
the right. same thing to happen to again. The Syrian Kurds, the Syrian Democratic Forces that have had the U.S. has fed their greed as well. Rather than wide federal autonomy, which they were likely to get in cooperation with Damascus and Russia, now that they're putting that at risk as well. So all the aftermath of all of this in Iraq has a big repercussion on what is happening in eastern Syria with the potential for, partition by U.S.-backed Kurds there as well. I think hopefully they'll draw a lesson from this and downsize their demands. They deserve something, but they have to be realistic. None of the states around them are going to acquiesce to an independent Kurdish state, and they just – that is the political reality, whether you like it or not.
There's a huge geopolitical stake there, too, and some interesting games that we've discussed some as they've developed. Turkey, with, you know, let's go back to December, 2 years ago, was it, when Turkey shot down a Russian plane that was clearly, you know, we were looking at, oh my goodness, are we on a slippery slope to World War III with the NATO shoot down of a Russian plane, to the situation now where Russia and Turkey have changed relations for sure from that moment. And Russia is involved as a, you know, at least as a broker in a number of places around it. And Turkey is staking out what looks like an independent position, certainly for a NATO member.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that they are there on the fritz from NATO, that that relations between NATO and Turkey, and between, in particular between the U.S. and Turkey, have been better.
Yeah.
But I do not expect any permanent geopolitical split. I do not expect Turkey to leave NATO. Their military is too intrinsically involved and dependent on Western military supply lines. You know, the majority of the Turkish economy is still focused towards the EU, which they will never be let into.
Yeah, right.
As a formula, they will continue to be a second class, hanger on of the European Union with an association agreement.
But there's enough there as a foil, though, to the U.S. saying, okay, Kurds, you can set up a state in eastern Turkey. Turkey's definitely in a position where that is foiled. The U.S. does not have a free hand to play like that at the moment.
No, they don't. And they need Turkish military air bases for the continued influence in the region. And they're just not willing to give those up. So I don't expect that split is permanent. If Hillary Clinton was president now, I expect that Turkey would have already reconciled with the United States. With Trump, that'll continue on until however long he remains in office, and then there will be an opportunity to push things under the rug and move on. It has to be remembered that, there would not be the civil war, the international jihad, the rebels in Syria, in anything like there was without constant military supplies, economic aid, funding, salaries, all of which was flowing all across the border from Turkey and northern Syria. And it continues to this day. Al-Qaeda dominated Idlib. They get supplied by Turkey.
Right.
They get supplied through the, whether it's deliberately by the Turkish government or Turkish interests, business, Islamists and so on. The Turkish border is open, and probably a mix of the two. The Turkish border is open, supplying Idlib has been all along. These rebel controlled areas, and certainly Al Qaeda controlled Idlib, they're not economically productive, right? They need food, they need money, they need an economy, right. And this wartime economy is supplied from outside.
Right.
Along with Turkey, you've got Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, and previously the U.S. and the other Western countries all pouring money in, but it all had to be delivered through Turkey, and it still is.
Right.
Turkey has moved troops into Idlib in Syria. As part of what was supposed to be this Astana agreement with Russia and Iran, but they're not there they're not taking control of their section, the section of Idlib that they're supposed to police from Al Qaeda. They're coordinating and cooperating with Al Qaeda.
Right.
They officially got escorts from Al Qaeda to set up three checkpoints. Not against Al-Qaeda, but against the Kurds in the Afrin Canton in western Syria, which at this point is almost completely surrounded. There's only one small border with the Syrian government, and Turkey would very much like to cut them off. At the same time, in the area north central Syria directly occupied by Turkish military forces and their Free Syrian Army, now often dubbed the New Syrian Army, as they call it. In that area there, Erdogan isn't going anywhere. He regards that territory as historically belonging right. to the Turkey, to the Ottoman Empire. Right. And just in the past couple of weeks, brand new Turkish government post offices were opened up in Jarablus, Syria. By the Turkish government. Erdogan, the Sultan's not going anywhere.
The first time since like 1923 or something when they signed the final treaty on Turkey. Yeah.
So, you know, I think Putin and Erdogan are waltzing with daggers at each other's back. But dancing with Erdogan is like, you know, clutching a snake to your breast. He will twist and skirm, the entire way, but his options are increasingly limited. Now, Erdogan had a good relation with the Iraqi Barzani Kurds. You know, this they were rather than paying oil, sending oil to Baghdad and then being redispersed a part of it out, the Barzani clan was just simply selling all the oil themselves and transporting it out of the country in jury-rigged convoys up through Turkey. And this was the same oil informal pipeline, if you will, that ISIS was using. These two ran parallel up into Turkey and then, you know, out into the wider world. Turkey was essentially oil laundering, if you will. And they had good relationships. Turkish troops that were in Iraq in defiance of the Iraqi government, they were invited in by the Barzani Kurds. So, you know, as much as Turkey is at war with the PKK, the Kurds in Iraq and in Turkey, eastern Turkey and Syria, they had good cozy relations with these Barzani Kurds up until the independence referendum, which was a step too far. Oops. Now, suddenly, Turkey has completely reversed itself. It's handed over control of a border area back to the Iraqi government. It's performed military drills on the border of Kurdish-controlled areas with the Iraqi government and, closed all kinds of airspace and everything else. And one has to assume that even this oil convoy pipe, you know, this system has probably been shut down at this point. And certainly they rejected the Kurdish independence bid. Right. The Americans threw them on the bus. They declared their neutrality and called for dialogue and everything, and they didn't step up to their longtime Kurdish partners. And the Iraqi government in the last few days has started taking back all of this excess 40% outside the formal borders of the Kyrgyzstani regional government, starting with Kirkuk, which is the big oil prize, but also Sinjar. A whole host of territory has already been recovered along the region, and this important border crossing into Syria. What part of the reason this happened, and it happened with only a few skirmishes, and then the Peshmerga completely abandoned their positions. This is because of the division among the Iraqi Kurds themselves. The Talabani clan, which control their own Peshmerga, they have always been closer to the Iraqi government. In fact, during a Kurdish civil conflict in the 90s, the late 80s, 90s, they're the ones who went to Saddam Hussein and asked them for help fighting Barzani. They are also have become very close with Iran, in particular the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and its, you know, almost legendary commander, its general. When Iraqi troops came to Kirkuk by plan, the Peshmergas, under the control of the Talabani clan, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, they abandoned their positions. And they re-announced their loyalty to the Iraqi government in Baghdad. And the Barzani Kurds, their Peshmerga, were left in a completely undefendable position in Kirkuk elsewhere and had no option but to withdraw. So there was significant division. The Kurds, you know, they failed here three ways. One, they trusted the Americans again. The American government that has thrown them under the bus before. And you know, the Americans promised them the moon if they would be their useful idiots, right. You know, but then threw them under the bus. Two, they got too greedy. If they had been content within the borders of the Kurdistani regional government, hadn't tried to seize this extra 40% of Iraqi territory, including Kirkuk, and then hadn't tried to extend the referendum as well to those areas, they might have gotten away with some of it. And the third thing is their own division amongst their own ranks, this clan warfare within Iraq, you know, the Barzanis against the Talibani, their respective political parties, but also the Barzanis' division from the Kurds in Syria and Iran and elsewhere. And now the Talibani clan are probably going to be in ascendance. I don't expect that the Iraqi government will push beyond retaking this 40% of extra territory. Once they reach the 2003 borders of what was agreed on as the Kurdistani regional government, they will stop there. But they will probably demand what is sorely needed, fresh elections in the KRG, which, you know, Masoud Barzani is several years over his tour of office and still just hanging on to power with new elections. He has a good possibility of losing. He's been looting all of this oil money dry. For instance, teachers in the KRG have not been paid in some time. They were going on strike over the last few weeks. They've been unpaid for months to years at this point, while the Barzani clan is getting filthy rich off of the oil lucre. So all of the geopolitical implications, of course, for Iraq, reduced U.S. influence in the region, some minor rebalancing with Turkey away from the U.S. and NATO, although not any type of permanent rupture, I don't think. But also it extremely reduces the chance for any partition of eastern Syria using the Kurdish majority SDF by the United States. That was always a fool's bet. I don't understand. I understand why the U.S. Under Trump didn't want to continue to support the Islamists. And it was good that Trump stopped what had been Obama's funding of arming, training, and salaring sectarian militants, you know, Islamists,
terrorists,
were literally allied and embedded with al-Qaeda. There's no question about that. That is, you know, they were doing that. And it's good that Trump stopped that. The Pentagon were always happier working with the Kurds because they are secular, and the CIA were happy working with the Islamists. But when the U.S. hitched its partition plans in eastern Syria to the Kurds, and the Kurds are only a majority in a small area in Syria. The Kurds are less than 8% of Syria's population, and they now control a territory that is 20% of Syrian territory.
It's 2.5 times their weight. They're punching
And comprising 40% of Syria's natural resources, oil and gas. You know, and this just isn't going to be allowed to stand. And once ISIS is defeated, the U.S. will have their options extremely limited, and I think that they will have to back out. And the Kurds, if they haven't realigned and they're still dreaming that they're going to have an independent state from Syria, they're going to be badly disappointed.
I mean,
these events in Turkey are a herald of what is to come for the Kurds in Syria if they continue down this maximalist position path. They've earned something for not turning on the Syrian government, at least up till now. The Syrian government in Damascus would have fallen at any time in the last 6 years if the Kurds had sided with the Islamist rebels. Instead, the Kurds fought the Islamist rebels and ISIS, and at various times had cooperation with the Syrian government and the Russian and Iranian allies. But the SDF has fallen far too far under the spell of the U.S. and its promises, and the U.S. has fed these maximalist, unrealistic dreams of the Kurds. They've made the PK, these SDF leaders have made statements about, oh, they'll never allow Syrian government control over the areas they've taken and so on, over Raqqa and other areas, and that's just not in the cards.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.